So our next speaker is Gregory. He has gracefully shared his bio with me, so I'll just read it. So Gregory is a fellow of the Actuarial Society. He currently serves as the chair of the Damages and Compensation Committee. He's also a trustee on the Actuarial Society Educational Trust. He has extensive experience in medical malpractice litigation and is regularly called upon by the Medical Protection Society and Department of Health as an expert witness. In 2021, he authored a research paper on behalf of ASA and the medical malpractice in South Africa public sector. In 2019, he was a recipient of the Actuarial Society Presidential Award. So we are very glad to have you today. And I think your subject is a vital one in our space. And it certainly is a big problem from a health system perspective. I have my questions of my own, which I will ask afterwards. Thank you.
What are you waiting for? Call Kenneth Ingram Jr. now.
Did you know that medical negligence is the third leading cause of death in the United States? Nothing is more precious than life itself. If you feel that you or your loved one is or has been a victim of medical negligence, then don't wait another second. Call me today and I will go to work for you.
Kenneth Ingram Jr., champion of the common man.
I'm going to just be covering three sections today. The first one is going to be basically our marriage to the law. Something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. And then, and that's certainly in respect of medical malpractice claims. And then I'm going to look at marriage counseling, which is basically the South African Law Reform Commission and the work that they're doing. And then the last section that I'm going to look at is just some commentary around their discussion paper and also perhaps grounds for divorce. So if we start with something old, so basically the first reported case of medical malpractice in South Africa was the matter of Lee versus Schoenberg, which is 145 years ago in 1877. In that matter, the plaintiff, who was a trader, sued a doctor practicing in Malmesbury for alleged negligent treatment following an injury. He alleged that due to the treatment received, he was prevented from practicing his trade, and he was obliged to expend large sums of money to get cured, and he claimed £500 in damages. The defendant adduced expert evidence in the matter to show that Dr. Schoenberg performed his duties with reasonable skill and care, and the plaintiff's case was dismissed with costs as he failed to show that Dr. Schoenberg had breached the duty of care owed to him. If we turn to something new, there was a very important case about a month ago in the Northwest High Court. And there, importantly, the court ruled that proof of a breach of duty of care does not axiomatically lead to proof causation. So normally with a medical malpractice claim, there's a five-stage inquiry to establish negligence. And basically the five-step process is to firstly establish an existence of a duty of care, and then you need to prove that there was a breach of that duty which causes reasonably foreseeable harm. So each five of those things need to be satisfied for a claim to succeed. In this particular case, the court found that there was a breach of duty and care in terms of which the hospital staff and nursing staff did not monitor the mother and the fetus properly, but the plaintiff failed to actually prove causation. In particular, they found that the birth injury was not caused in the last few hours before birth. So that claim was dismissed with costs. So I've begun by citing two cases and no legislation or no act. And that's basically because in South Africa there is no medical malpractice legislation. The cases are governed by the common law. And when I refer to the common law in South Africa, it basically is quite simply defined as the law that is practiced that's not written down in legislation. So South African common law is basically a hybrid or a mixed legal system. It borrows from Roman Dutch law, English common law, and these common law systems are recognized alongside the customary law of South Africa. So all these types of claims are adjudicated via the common law. Turning to something blue, so basically the contingent liability for medical claims across the 9 provincial health departments has ballooned from 28.6 billion for the financial year ending March 2015 to about 120.3 billion for the financial year ending March 2021. As Barry mentioned in his presentation earlier, the public health care budget is about 230 billion, so the current contingent liability is over 50% of that annual budget. From April 2012 to March 2021, the monies earmarked for public health care have been reduced by some 10.5 billion rand as a result of claim settlements. And to put that into further context, the basic salary for an entry-level staff nurse in a public hospital is around 14.5 thousand rand a month. So 1 billion rand a year would really result in another 5,750 staff nurses being employed in the public sector. There's also, obviously, there's an ugly side to the industry. There's always aspects of touting. In addition, the current Minister of Health in Eastern Cape noted that since the department uses a manual filing system, some healthcare workers have stolen files, they sell files to attorneys, and it therefore makes it very difficult for the department to defend itself. There's also accusations of collusion between role players, and there are some SIU investigations in that regard. So that just sets the scene of what's been going on in the public sector. Meanwhile, in the United Kingdom, in last week's news, there was a study into the UK's NHS compensation scheme, and it revealed that it's not fit for purpose and reform is long overdue. They mentioned that claims are set to double over the next in the next decade to about £4.6 billion a year, and many reasons cited for the failings of the system are also true in South Africa. So, for example, lessons are very rarely learned. We don't harness the data that's available. Accessing compensation is slow. The court system's adversarial. And the biggest priority in the system, which should be the prevention of harm, is overlooked. So now we have the entering of the South African Law Reform Commission. So basically the South African Law Reform Commission is a statutory body. It's established by the South African Law Reform Commission Act. Their objective is to perform research into all branches of the law in South Africa and to make recommendations for the development, improvement, modernization, or reform of the law. Their powers and duties include drawing up a program for matters of consideration by the Minister of Justice. Although in this particular instance, they received a request from the National Department of Health and the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services to investigate the medical legal problem. Obviously, the reason cited for the investigation is the escalation in claims and the increasing financial implications for the fiscus. So, an issue paper was published on the 17th of July, 2017, with the aim to investigate the problem, disseminate information, initiate debate, and seek proposals for reform. So, the The first step in the process of legal reform is an issue paper, and then that serves as a basis for a further deliberation. So following the issue paper, they released discussion paper 154, which was published on the 11th of November 2021. Comments for the paper closed on the 28th of February this year. The document is over 450 pages, and it's organized into 10 chapters. Chapter 1 is just an introduction to the scope of the problem and the purpose of the investigation. Chapter 2 sets out the South African legal landscape. Chapter 3 discusses relevant constitutional provisions. Chapter 4 discusses the development of the common law. Chapter 5 examines various reports, including the ASSA report, where we were mentioned. And then Chapter 6 examines previous government-initiated reports. Chapter 7 provides a comparative study of various compensation schemes around the world, such as those in New Zealand, Scandinavia, Wales, and the UK. And Chapter 8 provides a step-by-step strategy in dealing with claims. And then Chapter 9, which I'll focus on the next few slides, basically sets out the proposed solutions to the medical legal problem. And then Chapter 10 just summarizes the various written submissions that were made on issue paper 33. So if we look at the run through some of the proposed solutions that are set out in the discussion paper, one can sort of categorize them into various compartments. So if one looks at the first four solutions, they basically fall squarely within the Department of Health and require implementation. For me, I think the most important paragraph in this whole 450-page document is basically something I'll quote, and where the researcher says that it must be stated emphatically that legislative intervention alone cannot address the myriad of challenges faced by the public health sector. As is often said, there is no claim without negligence. Legislation can address procedure, establish bodies to deal with some issues, create interventions that do not currently exist, alter the method and timing of compensation and so forth, but legislation cannot address systemic problems with leadership, governance, management, budgeting and procurement, quality of care, lack of skills, personnel shortages, training, attitudes of staff and maintenance of facilities and equipment. The best legislation in the world will not make any difference unless it is applied, implemented, complied with, and monitored. So, if we turn to the next few solutions. So the next set of solutions basically just deal with pre-trial procedures, including making mediation compulsory. It includes pre-mediation clauses in admission forms in public hospitals, and also requiring a certificate of merit to avoid frivolous, meritless, fraudulent, or abandoned claims. The next set of solutions deal with really the expediting claims. So in order to expedite claims, a number of recommendations are made, including adopting an administrative compensation system for smaller claims, barring a plaintiff from proceeding with a claim after a period of inaction, and also introducing civil process changes to limit delays and expedite proceedings. As we found in the ASSA research paper, roughly the average time from the date of the medical incident to the date of trial or settlement was around about 9 years. So it's a pretty unacceptable situation where you've got a severely disabled child, for example, that has to wait 9 years before any treatment can actually take place. The next set of solutions also is just they revolve around court proceedings. So here the suggestion is to introduce the use of joint expert witnesses, because what you often find in some of these cases is some of the lengthy matters. I mean, there was one match in the Western Cape where they had on the order of 64 experts, 32 on both sides, the plaintiff and the defendant, and that's obviously an enormous cost. Providing for a panel of three expert witnesses for specialized technical evidence, and providing for the appointment of specialist assessors for matters involving complex medical evidence. We've seen a lot of inconsistencies in terms of judgments, where judges often do not grasp the concepts, and especially on issues such as causation and some of the medical evidence that's adduced during the course of a trial. So that would be a welcome change. The next three slides will all revolve around the compensation system. And the proposal is that structured settlements should be the norm for compensation. To date, it's just been via the once-and-for-all rule, which is just simply a lump sum payment in cash, and that's the end of the matter. So a structured settlement essentially comprises a lump sum cash payment for certain heads of damages, such as general damages and past medical expenses, a payment in kind for services that can be offered in a public institution, such as physiotherapy and occupational therapy, and then a periodic payment for services that cannot be delivered by a public institution. So there, we would look at things like the long-term caregiving costs and so on. So the largest part of any catastrophic birth injury claim is generally the cost of future care. It can range from 4,000 rand a month to 45,000 rand a month, depending on what's agreed by the experts involved. So it's specifically that type of expense where it's proposed to introduce periodic payments. For many claims involving child claimants, there's often a disagreement about their prospects. So there's often a claim for loss of earnings as well that's instituted in these matters, and normally they call upon industrial psychologists to give an opinion about the future prospects. There's also a proposal here to base the claim for loss of income on a more structured format. Or a guideline based on, for example, average national income, as opposed to what can really only be called crystal ball gazing by some experts. There's also a mention of introducing caps on damages, such as general damages, but to date, the highest award for general damages has been around about 3 million. So in South Africa, general damages are fairly low, and we don't have a punitive system like they do in the US, so you don't have these multi-million rand awards for things like for punitive damages or general damages. So there's some discussion as to who should administer periodic payments, whether, for example, SASSA's functions could be expanded to administer them, or whether each province should administer the periodic payments. They also envisage a deviation from the once-and-for-all rule to adjust periodic payments in exceptional circumstances. It's worth mentioning in 2017, the Constitutional Court interpreted the once-and-for-all rule to mean that damages due in law are to be awarded in money. Damages may not be paid in periodic payments or installments, and a defendant may not compensate a plaintiff by providing medical services in the place of damages. So there has been an evolution of that since that judgment. There was a minority judgment in in the Constitutional Court judgment where they basically left the door open for the development of the common law to allow these sorts of things. So, but the problem is that it's dealt with on a case by case basis. So you'd have to adduce evidence in any particular matter to make out a case as to why a periodic payment should be preferred to a lump sum, given, for example, the location of the claimant. But this is why there's a need to really go the legislative route, so as to circumvent these ongoing cases around these various aspects. There's a few other proposals that include taking relevant research into account, especially with regards to claims for cerebral palsy. There's a lot of literature and debate around causation in those matters, and that it's one of the most problematic areas in proving these claims, because so much can go wrong in the birthing process and prior to birth. And if any of you saw the public interest seminar last year, there was a presentation from Professor Colleen Wright, who's a specialist in placental pathology, and it's essential that one examines the placenta because it often provides clues as to things that went wrong during birth. So it's a field that requires a lot of attention, and to date the courts have not, in my opinion, have not done a very good job of determining causation. There's obviously there's a lot of talk about reviewing the training and qualification of nurses. And then obviously one of the contentious issues with attorneys is amending the Contingency Fees Act to provide for a sliding scale for contingency fees, because as it stands at the moment, for a 10 million rand award, an attorney can charge 2.5 million rand in fees, provided that's the the Contingency Fee Act basically reads that you're entitled to charge double your hourly rate or 25% of the capital, whichever is the lesser. So what often happens is a lot of these attorneys don't account for their hourly rates. They just sort of take the 25% capital, sometimes more, and sail off into the sunset. There's also a recommendation to introduce a Good Samaritan law, which is which would exempt a medical practitioner from negligence where they are acting in an emergency situation, such as we saw by way of an example in the state of New York. They introduced a moratorium on malpractice claims, except in cases of gross negligence, while medical staff were supporting the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So we move to just some commentary about these proposals. There was a disappointing lack of comments received on issue paper 33 from representatives of the South African disability sector or the Department of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities. Disabled People South Africa's mission statement is nothing about us without us. And it would have been useful to have had formal input from non-profit organizations who represent the view of people living with disabilities and the impact that large medical legal claims actually have on them. Discussion paper 154 seeks to make certain procedural changes to what can only be described as a constitutionally unfair system. Structured settlements won't necessarily reduce the contingent liability by much, but it will ease the Department of Health's cash flow in the short term, and it also may obviously result in a lessened appetite for pursuing birth injury claims by attorneys, but it obviously depends how contingency fees will be determined, because even within a structured settlement situation, there still will be some cash available, and if they don't amend the Contingency Fee Act properly, there could still be conceivably a situation where the notional award is 10 million rand. It could be 2.5 million rand in cash, 2.5 million rand in kind, and 5 million rand in periodic payments, and the attorney still takes 25% of the notional value of the claim. So one has to guard against things like that happening. There's essentially a face-off between the right of an individual's common law claim for damages pursuant to harm caused by negligence of the state against the constitutional rights to healthcare services of the greater community. There also exists a differentiation between birth-injured children who have had access to legal representation and those living with birth disorders due to genetics or chance. By no fault of man. So on the one hand, we have awards being made of sort of over 20 million rand in respect of one individual. And then on the other hand, we have parents of children living with mobility disabilities resorting to to using wheelbarrows as wheelchairs because there's just such a scarcity. So some of the ways to untie the state's hands with these claims that we suggested. So one is when considering the research on cerebral palsy, one can only speculate on the number of findings made against provincial departments of health or cases settled because of incomplete evidence placed before the court, incomplete health records, or applying the wrong evidence. So the courts really need to get the science right when it comes to adjudicating, especially birth injury claims, which are the bulk of claims. We discussed this at length in the ASA research report. It's also become sort of common practice to consider CTG monitoring during the trial. The courts have ruminated on the frequency or the infrequency of conducting monitoring, the disappearance of CTG tracing printouts from the files, and also the interpretation of the tracing printouts and so forth. The courts have relied heavily on this tool, but it's really just one tool that cannot really be used to prove causation on a standalone basis. So some of the comments on structured settlements. I think the consideration should be given to the possible cost savings to the state of using, for example, a standardized discount rate when determining these claims, and that can also perhaps inform the decision as to whether or not to pay awards as structured settlements, because certainly one of the comments made by the Eastern Cape Treasury is that in their experience, depending on the evidence led in a particular matter, the discount rate can vary. So some plaintiffs get evidence from for example an economist, and they'll paint a picture of what medical inflation will be in future, and then that feeds its way into the capitalization rates and ultimately the lump sum. And in those matters where economists are being used, the settlements tend to be higher than those where the actuary determines the assumption. But there's no uniform discount rate in play here, whereas in other countries, for example, in the UK and Australia, there are standardized discount rates for compensation claims. A blanket default system is not supported. One has to give consideration to the size of the ward and also the extra administrative burden of that's entailed. Then lastly, if you enter into sort of a periodic payments scenario, actual increases in services may differ from agreed or legislated increases, with the result that, like contingency fees, claimants leave the litigation cycle with less funding than they require for the actual for their scheduled needs. The paper also mentions the availability of new and improved public health services or new treatment options that were previously lacking or inadequate, but that will require the state to develop protocols on the basis of efficacy and affordability. They also mention that one could make an application to show grounds for the deviation from the once-and-for-all rule, but one would assume that it would still involve some kind of litigation or application process, which would again result in administrative delays, and it would be to the detriment of claimants seeking early intervention. And then importantly, feedback loops. I mean, a critical piece of information and information that's missing here, and one that I am involved in researching, is exactly what has happened to these settlements. There's a preliminary view is that there's a massive mismatch between the actual settlement values in court orders and the amounts that actually reach the trusts that are supposed to be set up for these children, if in actual fact a trust is even set up, because in some instances there's just no record or no account of what's actually happened to the money. There's matters where, for example, a 16 million rand settlement was made, I think it was in the December of 2015, and then 3 months later the child actually died, but the money was still paid to the estate. So that money was actually earmarked for the future care of the child, but because there was no mechanism in our law to recoup the money just went to the beneficiaries of the estate. And by the time that happened, there was only 7 million rand left. So 9 million rand went missing. And not only that, but I think the attorney who handled the case became the executor of the estate. So there's horrific things that go on, and one needs to try and unpack what's actually happened to the money. And that'll obviously also probably be the best evidence to inform the lump sum system and doing away with it. Until then, there have been some mechanisms that have been developed. For example, the Western Cape Department of Health developed a reversionary trust where basically if the child dies before the agreed life expectancy, the money reverts back to the state. But all the other 8 provinces haven't implemented that system. But the Western Cape system does need refinement. They basically do need to only allow top-ups to the fund until the agreed life expectancy is applied. In the one particular matter that I'm aware of, I think the wording was incorrect in the trust agreement, and basically as soon as the money ran out, the child ended up back in the public healthcare system and is now applying for top-ups. And then if you think, Barry was talking about the slow pace of reform, and if you think we are slow, the first quote is from the Clinton administration, the next one's from the Bush administration, the next one is from the Obama administration, and the last one is from the Trump administration, and basically they've all considered reining in medical malpractice lawsuits, they've all considered imposing caps, but it's all been almost 30 years and it's just been talk. And then, in conclusion, just some comments. I think whether or not the compensation system uses structured settlements or lump sum payments, the compensation is essentially targeted at the individual. So until it can be proven that guardians actually utilize awarded funds and or payments in kind to actually benefit the birth injured child, medical legal litigation remains an exercise in procedure and profits. And it's important I think the time is ripe to consider or to weigh up competing rights. So, as I mentioned, I mean, can this country afford a situation where a few individual claimants who, as the discussion paper refers to, basically get the lottery ticket, and are getting 20, 30 million rand payments? How can we have that situation where there's so much need and want, and people are going without so much? So I think, in terms of, and I'm sure, the pace of reform is slow. This is the discussion papers is not the end of it. Basically, there's going to be comments received. The researcher is going to collate all the comments. She's going to draft a report that's going to be in about 18 months' time. After that, she gets to draft potential legislation. And this is all going to take a long, long time. So what do we do in the meantime? And even when the legislation arrives, as we saw with the Road Accident Benefit Scheme bill that dragged on for almost 20 years, it finally got shelved, is this going to be another situation? So in the meantime, I think there needs to be some court action around things like competing rights. And I think the solution can be guided by entities such as NGOs. They should be part of service provision. I mean, we investigated some of the NGOs. I mean, they 3 prominent NGOs work on a budget less than 1 claim, and they're servicing something like 600 children in the rural Eastern Cape. So, you weigh that up against 20 million rand that's been maybe 10 million rand has ended up in the actual trust. This sort of thing can't be happening in South Africa. So I think the solution should be guided by NGOs as part of service provision, and I think the establishment of specialist rehabilitation clinics using funds traditionally earmarked for individual claimants should also factor into our solution set. And I think that's about all for me.
Many thanks, Gregory. Wow. So I thought healthcare was challenging. Thanks for the rude awakening. Thank you for the presentation. Doesn't look like there are any questions online. Okay. We'll go to the room. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. It was really interesting and great. I just wanted to ask around mediation. So you mentioned that as a proposed solution. I want to know how often it's being used currently, and when it is used, how successful it is, and how much money is saved and time is saved. And also, in terms of these solutions that are proposed, do they apply to both the public and private sectors? Thank you.
Okay, so on mediation, there has been a pilot project in Gauteng, but it hasn't really taken off much. Obviously, it requires buy-in from both parties, and I think one of the things that can go missing in mediation is that you don't have to disclose the terms of the agreement. So, whereas we've got like a case law where you can sort of ascertain what claim values have been for similar cases, something like that might not happen in a mediation environment. So that's one pitfall that I see in mediation. It certainly does speed up the process. But in the medical malpractice space, it's been quite slow to take off. And in actual fact, even in the road accident fund space, it's been quite slow to actually get going. But I do think it's a good. I'm also a trained mediator. I did a mediation course, and I sat through all of that. And it's a very different way of doing things. It's very interesting. But when you've got an attorney on the scene, there's obviously fees to be earned, so it does create. I don't see it unless it's made sort of almost like law. I don't see attorneys buying into it because it's not going to generate the kind of fees that they used to. And then your second question was on the whether it would apply to the private sector as well. I think at the moment it's just the original bill that was in place was the State Liability Amendment Bill, so that just deals with organs of state. It depends where they legislate. I don't know if they could legislate this through the National Health Act, but at the moment I think what I'm expecting to see is a rehash of the State Liability Amendment Bill, which just deals with the actions against the organs of state.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will not be quite democratic. I'm going to ask my own question. I think the progress on the legal front is encouraging in terms of the recommendations which are on the table. And then we also note the slow pace which you have warned us. My question is, from an actuarial perspective, we are risk managers. And in the private sector, I certainly know that there are efforts to try and help the medical practitioners keep better records. I think, latching on to what Emil shared this morning, if we collect data on these incidents and we start monitoring what's happening, is there a way we can start having some control in terms of limiting the liabilities, preventing the events from happening, and also keeping better records so that should a case arise, then the five things that you have highlighted, we can actually demonstrate that we have done everything that was humanly possible.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's an enormous gap and obviously an opportunity there, because I think there's, if I could give you some background, I mean, I received claims files from the various departments. And just that information alone was basically on maybe 90% of the matters, just basic things like the date of the malpractice incident was missing. In a lot of instances, you don't even know what the claim was for. It's just a claim, it's a summons. So there's huge scope to improve, firstly to digitize the whole system. And I think, like anecdotally, some of the public hospitals that have sort of digitized, the claims have sort of drifted away to other hospitals that aren't. So there's a huge scope to analyze the various incidents that are occurring. But beyond that, also proper claims reserving and just planning. So it's a vital ingredient that's missing. I mean, the state of record keeping is, as one can see in a lot of the cases, you often find the records go missing. So then the Department of Health has got very little to defend themselves on. And also you're sitting in a fairly ridiculous situation where you're expecting a doctor and a nurse to give evidence on a birth that occurred 10 years ago. I mean, you weren't mm-hmm. impossible to recollect where you were 10 years ago. And, and in the meantime, if that record's gone missing, what's going to happen? So, yeah, I mean, there's a huge opportunity to improve data, just basics, just get the basics right, just get the, especially in the claims files.
Okay, thanks for that. Would you like to go? Oh, okay, thank you. So thank you, everyone, for being with us. We are 19 minutes over time, so I hope we can have our lunch in 40 minutes. And the online guests, I think we'll see you after lunch. The interesting angle about the next presentation is now the how-to part. I think Barry was talking about don't use these words loosely, but make it a part of your everyday life as an actuary. So we'll learn how to try and get the incentive right in the world of value-based care. So enjoy your lunch. The invite is open to the online guests as well.